Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. This is part four of our 10-part audio series exploring the history of Afrin. Today we're focusing on a really pivotal period, wouldn't you say? The 16th to 18th centuries.
Absolutely. It's when things really start to solidify in terms of Kurdish settlement and, well, identity in the region we know as Kurdog under Ottoman rule.
And we're basing this on that collection of historical records, the travel accounts, and the scholarly analysis that you, our listener, shared with us. The idea today is to look specifically at how settlement, administration, the economy, and social life sort of came together to shape Afrin's identity during this Ottoman era, relying only on these sources.
Exactly. We want to see what patterns emerge from the documents of that time.
Okay, so let's start with the name itself, Kurdog. The sources seem to use it consistently.
They do, and that's actually quite telling right from the start. You see Kurdog, Mountain of the Kurds, or its Ottoman version, Kurdad, or the Arabic Jabal al-Akrad.
All meaning the same thing, basically.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And the key thing is these aren't modern terms. They appear in historical records from, you know, centuries ago, long before today's borders.
So it suggests that outsiders, administrators, travelers, they all saw the region as predominantly Kurdish.
That seems to be the clear implication from the sources, yes. It points to a perceived identity, a recognized Kurdish presence acknowledged by different historical actors over a long period.
And geographically, the sources place it northwest of Aleppo.
That's right. Mountainous terrain, some rolling hills, and these fertile valleys, especially the one carved out by the Afrin River. That landscape is crucial.
Influencing defense, farming. Everything, I imagine.
Exactly. And it wasn't isolated. The sources consistently show Kurdog deeply connected, both administratively and socioeconomically, to Kilis and Aleppo throughout this Ottoman period.
Kilis, which is just over the border today in Turkey.
Precisely. And this link to Kilis and Aleppo wasn't temporary. It was a constant feature for centuries. Understanding that connection is, well, vital for grasping the history before the major disruptions of the 20th century.
Okay, so we've got the place, the name signifying identity, and its strong regional ties. How did the Ottomans actually manage this mountain of the Kurds, especially early on, say the 16th century? You mentioned those Ottoman records.
Ah, yes, the Tahrir Defterleri. The cadastral surveys from the 16th century, they're incredibly valuable. They show that around 1536, the area was part of what was officially called the Liva Azez ve Ekrad.
The District of Azez and the Kurds. There it is again, right in the official title.
Explicitly. And the records even identify Jindires as the central village for the district at that time.
So how did they govern it? Was it direct rule?
Well, this is where it gets particularly interesting. For a significant period from around 1527 into the early 17th century, the Kilis Santak, which included Kurdag, operated under a specific system. It's called Yurtlukokakaluk.
Yurtlukokakaluk. Okay, what did that mean on the ground?
Think of it as a kind of hereditary grant of authority. It gave administrative power and, importantly, the right to collect revenue to a single powerful local family.
A local family,
yeah.
Not an Ottoman appointee.
Exactly. In this case, the sources name the Kampola Tozulara, or Jan Bulad family. This system made their local control hereditary, integrated within the broader Ottoman framework.
So the Ottomans were essentially co-opting or perhaps formalizing existing local power.
That seems to be the strategy, yes. Especially in areas with strong tribal structures. The sources mention the Ottomans appointing local Kurdish tribal chieftains, Ashret Waisi, like a figure named Zidin Bey, as the Sanjak Bey, the district governor.
Using local leaders to govern locally.
Right. It helped maintain stability, integrate the region, and of course, ensure revenue collection, particularly from groups the records specifically identify as Ekrad Zidinli, the Kurds associated with Azedin.
Makes sense from an imperial perspective. Leverage existing structures.
Absolutely. And while governorships might change hands, this Yurtlukokakaluk system under the Kampola Tozulara and the practice of appointing local figures like Azedin Bey really demonstrates a significant degree of localized Kurdish control operating within the Ottoman system during this formative time.
Okay, let's shift to daily life. How did people make a living there between the 16th and 18th centuries? The sources link it closely to the land, you said.
Very much so. Agriculture was, of course, fundamental. But what really stands out in the sources, something the region apparently became known for, was olive cultivation.
Olives specifically?
Yes. Extensive olive groves seem to have been a defining economic feature, suggesting a real specialization.
So not just subsistence farming, but producing a notable surplus of olives and oil.
That's the picture the sources paint. Farming techniques were likely traditional, similar to elsewhere in the Aleppo province, but the emphasis on olives is highlighted.
What else besides farming?
Animal husbandry. Pastoralism was also vital. And importantly, the sources explicitly mention the presence of nomadic and semi-nomadic Kurdish tribes in Kerb Dag going way back, documented since the 16th century.
So a mix of settled farming, specialized olive growing, and this long-standing pastoral tradition.
Exactly. And these weren't separate worlds. The surplus from both farming the olive oil, maybe grains, and from pastoralism wool, animals, it was all primarily traded in the markets of Kilis and Aleppo.
Reinforcing that connection we talked about earlier.
Precisely. It created this economic orientation, even dependence on those nearby urban centers.
Okay, what about the social structures? How was Kurdish society organized within Kurd Dag during this period, according to the sources?
Well, the sources consistently point to tribal structures as being absolutely central. Society was organized around lineage, usually patrilineal descent, tracing through the father's line, grouping families into clans, and sometimes larger confederations.
And these were more than just family groups.
Oh, yes. They functioned as key sociopolitical units. They were the building blocks of society in many ways.
And how did the Ottoman state interact with these tribes? Did they try to break them up?
Actually, the sources suggest the opposite, often. The Ottomans frequently engaged directly with the tribal leaders, the agas.
The agas, right.
They would often grant them official titles or specific responsibilities, effectively integrating them into the imperial administration. This could actually strengthen the aga's position.
So their authority wasn't just internal to the tribe. It got an official stamp, so to speak.
In many cases, yes. The sources indicate this legacy of aga influence, rooted in lineage, but also tied to local power and recognized by the state, goes right back to this period.
Any glimpses into sort of daily social customs?
We get a few hints. For example, the 16th century Kurdish historian Sharaf ad-Din Bitlisi, in his famous work, The Sharafnama, mentions things like polygyny being practiced among the Kurdish elite at the time. It gives us a small window into the social norms of that era.
What about land? Who owned it? How was it held?
The sources suggest the typical Ottoman land tenure systems were likely in place. You had miri land, which was technically state-owned, but people farmed it. Then mulk, which was private property. And waqf land, set aside for religious or charitable purposes, like supporting a mosque.
So probably a mix.
Most likely. Arable land was probably mostly miri. Olive groves, though, because they're a long-term investment, might have had a more complex status. Maybe private ownership, mulk, or very secure usage rights on miri land. Waqf would support local institutions.
The sources mention the 1858 land code sometimes, but that's later, right?
That's much later, yes.
Yeah.
The sources we're focusing on for this period, 16th, 18th century, don't detail its impact yet, though they sometimes note in broader discussions that such codes often ended up benefiting those already in power, like established landowning agas.
War. Got it. Okay, let's turn to religious identity. What did the sources tell us about the religious landscape in Kurd Dag during these centuries?
The sources offer fewer specific details for this exact period compared to, say, administration, but they definitely highlight religious diversity as a key part of the region's identity, even within the predominantly Kurdish population.
So not uniform?
Not entirely, no. The sources mention a form of Sufi-influenced Islam being common, sometimes referred to as Kurdish Islam. And interestingly, it's sometimes noted as having a degree of tolerance compared to maybe more rigid forms found elsewhere nearby. That characteristic seems part of the region's historical identity.
And beyond that expression of Islam.
Yes. Crucially, the sources consistently mention the presence of ethnically Kurdish Yazidi communities.
The Yazidis, right.
They have their own ancient religion, and the sources note their deep connection to specific sacred sites within Kurd Dag mountains, springs, shrines. This creates what you could call a sacred geography, intertwined with their identity in the region.
So the land itself holds religious meaning.
Very much so for the Yazidi community. The sources also mention the presence of Alevi communities, also ethnically Kurdish.
Alevi as well.
Yes, with their own distinct religious practices and often connections to specific lineage systems, sometimes called OKAKs, that trace back to Anatolia. This would also contribute to the cultural and religious tapestry of Kurd Dag.
So it sounds like you have this predominantly Kurdish population, but within that, A real mosaic of religious identities and practices coexisting.
That's a very good way to describe the picture emerging from the sources for this period. This mix, the Sufi-influenced Islam, the Yazidis tied to sacred geography, the Alevis with their distinct traditions, all contributed to the complex identity of Kurd Dagh.
Okay, so let's try to pull these threads together. We've talked about the Ottoman administration allowing local control through systems like Yurtluk Gökçeklik. We've discussed the economy, defined by olives and pastoralism, linked to Kilis and Aleppo. We've covered the vital role of tribal structures and agas, and now this religious mosaic. How do all these factors, documented in the 16th to 18th centuries, really point to that idea of a consolidation of Kurdish identity in the region?
Well, when you put it all together, what the sources consistently show is a region where Kurdish settlement wasn't just present, it was becoming deeply rooted and established. A distinct regional identity, reflected even in the name Kurd-Dagh, was taking shape and being recognized by others, Ottoman officials, travelers, historians. These centuries, from the 1500s to the 1700s, appear foundational. They cemented the demographic character, the key economic activities, the social structures, and the religious landscape that defined Kurd Dagh as a recognizable entity within the wider Ottoman world.
And understanding this specific period, this foundation, why is that so crucial for you, the listener, trying to follow the longer history of Afrin?
Because everything that comes later builds on this. This period shows you the baseline, if you will. How local Kurdish society functioned, how it related to the empire, where key economic patterns like olive growing came from, the long-standing influence of certain families or tribal structures, those deep ties to Kilis and Aleppo. These aren't things that just appeared in the 19th or 20th century. Their origins, according to these sources, lie right here in this 16th to 18th century period. It's the historical bedrock.
Right. So to quickly recap, we've seen how Ottoman administration acknowledged and used local Kurdish authority, how olives and pastoralism shaped the economy, the centrality of tribes and agas in society, and the diverse religious communities adding complexity, all contributing to Kurd Dagh's identity during the 16th, 18th centuries.
A period where the region's character really seems to have solidified.
And maybe a final thought to leave you with, drawing from what we've seen in the sources. When you consider those deep historical roots, the centuries of administrative links, the economic reliance on places like Kilis, the identity forged in Kurd Dagh over this long period, it really highlights just how profound and, well, disruptive later political decisions like drawing new state borders right through those connections must have been for a region with such an ingrained historical fabric. Thank you for joining us for this part of the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Thank you.
Next time, we'll continue our exploration of Afrin's past.